The challenges of exploration reflect themselves at every scale. You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. The road to success in planetary exploration is always a complex one. And that's true whether we mean the personal career path of an individual trying to build a vocation in this exciting and challenging domain, or of a spacecraft, escaping the Earth, flying across hundreds of millions of kilometers of emptiness, and arriving safely at its destination. The road is challenging, too, for space mission projects, complex technical endeavors to produce and operate those spacecraft, which are faced with scientific, engineering, and programmatic challenges that can lead to delays, changes, or cancellation of missions. And it's a challenging road, too, in the sense of history and of institutions. Managing a national space program is difficult, and budgetary, political, and other pressures can lead to difficult decisions, and spans of years and decades marked by long waits, brilliant payoffs, the excitement of success, and the disappointment of failure. Dr. Peter Smith knows that road at all those scales. He's built a long career in space science and worked on numerous missions over several decades to targets throughout the solar system. He was principal investigator for the 2008 Phoenix mission to Mars, and for the imager on the 1997 Pathfinder mission, and is now the imaging scientist for the OSIRIS-REx asteroid sample return mission. He is a professor and the Thomas R. Brown Distinguished Chair of Integrated Science at the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory of the University of Arizona. Western World's John Moores spoke with Dr. Smith at the November 2012 Canadian Space Summit about his path to becoming a planetary scientist and the challenges, costs, and recent history of planetary exploration programs, as well as the exciting OSIRIS-REx mission.
Thank you for joining me here today at the Canadian Space Summit here in beautiful London, Ontario, Canada. And let me just start off with, I understand that you have had an interesting path to get to space exploration. Would you mind telling us a little bit about that journey of yours?
Well, it started at the University of California at Berkeley in 1969 when I was a senior majoring in physics, and I managed to get a job at the spectroscopy lab run by Dr. Sumner Davis, and I started to learn about spectroscopy and all of its gory detail using, of course, photographic plates in those days on glass backgrounds. And as I was graduating from Berkeley, some of his students came back to visit. They were from Hawaii, and I said, gee, I'm just graduating. Do you have any jobs at the University of Hawaii? What could be more wonderful for a 20-year-old? And a month later, I did get a job offer. I thought I was going to be an observer on top of the mountain, but instead, they had a job for me in the spectroscopy lab, which they called the rocket spectrograph, because it flew on sounding rockets from White Sands, New Mexico. So I spent 5 years building spectrographs for flying into space and went through all the processes. We had a very small team, so we all did pretty much everything we had to do, including machining the parts and designing them and aligning and calibration. Every aspect that we do today in our space missions, we did for the sounding rockets. It was a great training program, and that's what got me started in space instrumentation.
And this was before you even did any graduate work as well, wasn't it?
Yes. So after 5 years, I figured maybe I should get some training in what I'm doing, and I went to optical sciences at the University of Arizona and eventually ended up across the street at Space Sciences, combining my love of optics with space instrumentation and space astronomy. So it turned out to be a good career for me.
How many space missions is it? Is it 11 now that you've been involved with, of the major ones?
Gosh, you've counted better than I have, but it's quite a few.
Well, what really sticks out when you think back on all of those?
Well, they go through a certain process. The design of the instrument, the calibration, and then the heartbreak when it doesn't seem to live up to its standards, and then the redesign and the recalibration. These things seem to happen with great frequency, and eventually we get to the launch pad, and that is one of the great thrills, to see something you've worked on launched away from the Earth, never to return. And I like to think that I have, not literally, but figuratively, my fingerprints on quite a few planets now. And then there's the actual getting to the object you've decided to study, and the thrill of either landing or going into orbit. It's like nothing else. And so you live with long periods of not so much tedium, but daily hard work, and then these brief moments of great thrill as you actually get data back or land on Mars or whatever you're going to do. It's a great career.
Now, of course, not every mission successfully makes it to its target. I mean, how do you feel about the ones that didn't quite make it?
Well, I was building the cameras for Pathfinder, and this was a mission that was given little chance of success, and it was thought to be a low-cost experiment in engineering technology to use airbags to land on Mars. Nobody was going to be upset or too surprised if it didn't work. So, of course, the opposite happened. It worked beautifully. Our pictures became treasures around the country because it had been 20 years since a landing on Mars. And these were really kind of exciting times as we drove a little rover around for the first time on Mars.
That's true. And didn't you present one of those pictures to President Clinton back in the day?
Yes, we went back to visit Clinton. Unfortunately, at the time we got there, one of his good friends had died in Arkansas and he'd left town. So we instead were allowed to meet with Vice President Gore, which was not quite the thrill we had anticipated, but it was nice to meet him. He didn't show too much interest. So anyway, we'd had a tremendous success with Pathfinder, and then the next mission, Mars Polar Lander, exactly the opposite. After all the work of preparing cameras and designing procedures for trying to understand the South Polar region of Mars, we lost it on entry and never received a single picture back. It was totally a heartbreak. So I experienced the great thrill of success and the very deep pain of failed mission.
And of course, we seem to be getting a better and a better record on Mars these days.
Yes, the days in the 90s were days of the faster, better, cheaper program, where cost was the overriding concern. So you had to do it cheaply. That meant that your bench was very shallow. You didn't have more than one person working on some of the key parts of a mission. And after the loss of the orbiter and lander in 99, it was thought that was a bad way to do things. So now we really take time to ensure that the risk is low. That means usually we run a little over cost.
I guess, of course, in some ways, the 90s were an improvement on the 80s, in which there wasn't a whole lot of activity going on.
Yes.
We hear stories all the time now about budgets under pressure in the United States and elsewhere, and it comes back to some of these discretionary programs like Planetary Science Program. Are there any sort of lessons from the 1980s for where we might be going, what not to do?
Well, as you know, the 1980s were the presidency of Ronald Reagan, and the idea of smaller government and reducing the number of space missions was certainly a simpler way for him to reduce cost. And then there was the Challenger disaster, I think it was 86, and that put everything on hold. So there was really a dearth of missions at that time. And unfortunately, there was a Mars mission plan, Mars Observer, and it was lost just as it got to orbit around Mars. So there was kind of a sad time for us. It was almost 13, 14 years where there was really nothing happening.
That's true. Well, it does look like things have stormed back with the most recent missions. And sort of since you've been in this field now for quite a few years, where do you sort of see us going in terms of Mars exploration and in terms of planetary exploration more broadly?
Well, this is something that's been discussed at this conference, as a matter of fact. We are all hopeful. David Beatty is here. He's one of the space policy experts, and he is promoting the Mars sample return, and he would like to see it start in 2018 or 2020. These are opportunities to go to Mars where you can really bring a large payload with you and land in vast range of choice locations. You have to choose one, of course, but you have a wide range of choices. So We'd really like to get back to Mars at the end of this decade with a sample return type of mission. Now, that's expensive, too. So we wonder, given the climate in Washington, and there's going to be certain pressure on NASA itself to reduce cost, whether they're willing to undertake such an ambitious mission. We'll just have to wait and see.
Fair enough. And certainly the opportunities at the end of this decade are better than what they will be in the 2020s. It won't be until the 2030s that we get those chances again.
That's right. And so when people ask about human missions to Mars, the real next opportunity is 2033 is the number I've heard. I'm not sure that's correct, but somewhere around that time frame. And that means getting started in a few years. We don't even have the launch vehicle now. So there's a lot of development that would have to take place in order to get humans to Mars in 2033. As it was pointed out at this conference, you could get humans to Mars and back, but return them alive is not an easy thing.
That's true. That's something that doesn't really constrain the robots quite so
no,
much.
No, that makes the robot missions very attractive. Nobody's going to die.
Well, one question that I know I often get asked when I give talks out to the public is sometimes folks will see these price tags. So, for instance, with Mars Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory mission, they see $2.5 billion and they wonder, why? Why do we spend this money on doing planetary exploration?
Well, we've just spent $2.5 billion in advertising for the presidential election. And what have we accomplished there? Those were the most negative set of ads we've ever seen. People wouldn't even watch them after a while. They were so discouraging about the level of discourse in our country. So I think $2.5 billion, while it sounds like a lot, it's not spent in 1 year. It's spent over sometimes 8-10 years. And so the amount per year is not as large as it sounds when you get the total cost. And the return is that you have engaged the hearts and minds of some of your best talented engineers in the country on a peaceful exercise, not designing war equipment, but designing instrumentation and rocketry that takes us on missions of exploration that have for the first time in the history of mankind been made possible. So I think this is the time to do it. We should be doing it. It's a peaceful process. We involve the whole world. The data return is available to any person in the world. It's a human activity. Let's continue.
And I guess when you think about it in terms of the cost per person, it is quite a bit lower as well. I think it works out to $7 or $8 in total and maybe $1 a year in terms of the time spent. There seems to be a lot that you get out of it as well. As you mentioned, having that spacecraft there, having that expression of beautiful, peaceful use of exploration technology.
That's right. It's a sense of accomplishment that we did this, and we meaning every person in the United States, because we're all helping to pay for this. And I shouldn't limit it to the United States because we've had a lot of Canadian involvement and we've had a lot of European involvement. And I know that in Japan and China and India, there's a tremendous interest for these type of missions. I think Brazil is also coming on board with a space program. Everybody really wants a part of this because it's an endeavor that brings honor to the Earth.
That's true. And right now, the U.S. is unquestionably the leader in this particular field. But the Europeans, more and more, are coming up. And who knows, maybe another nation will take some leadership there. Certainly some, you tend to start by supplying little pieces and grow from there.
Well, I tend to ask people, I show a picture when I give a talk of an astronaut on Mars. Of course, it's a painting. And the flag on the arm of the astronaut is an American flag. But I say, do we really know this is going to be an American flag when the first human steps onto Mars? Or even if it's a country we know of today, there could be 100 years before we actually get a person to Mars. And things could be quite different.
That's true. Now, moving beyond sort of the governmental realm, what is sort of the role for space enterprise here for private companies? I know that there's been talk of SpaceX sending capsules to Mars for robotic and scientific use.
Yeah, that's probably not the first use of their space vehicles. I think they're going to have to walk before they run. Missions to Mars are quite difficult, particularly if you want to land. If you want to go into orbit, it's not quite so bad, but even then, there's a lot of expertise they'd have to build up. So I think they're going to be doing Earth orbit missions for quite some time until they really get confident that their rockets are reliable, that they can lower the risk of launch so that they can get backers for payloads that would be required to send to Mars. I think it's going to be some time before they can convince people that have to put up the money that the money is not going to blow up on the launch pad.
That's true. And that's one of the arguments, of course, for a robust program, that you keep those people with that knowledge and that expertise who've done it before and been there. you keep them going.
Well, right now we have a competition to go to the moon, the Google X Prize, and there's a number of groups that are attempting to gain that prize. Unfortunately, the prize is less than the cost of the mission, so you really have to put some money into it, and you have to think of a business plan that goes with it. And there's a number of groups that have done that and are pursuing this goal, so I'm hopeful in the next decade that we'll see a private mission to the moon.
That would definitely be interesting to see. Now, speaking of objects that aren't Mars, your most recent sort of employment is working with a new mission heading out to an asteroid. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, the mission is called OSIRIS-REx. It's a long kind of mythical name that really means that we are going to an asteroid, and this is an Earth-crossing asteroid, so it's not distant outside the orbit of Mars. It's actually crosses Earth orbit. It's not exactly in the same plane as the Earth orbit. It's tilted by several degrees. So we would launch in 2016 with the goal of encountering the asteroid about 2018 and 19, and then gathering a sample from its surface. This is important, and we have chosen a special asteroid that we hope has organic material on its surface. It's important because when meteors, which are little chunks of asteroids, come to the Earth, they have to go through the atmosphere at high speed, and they're heated to tremendously high temperatures and modified. So to get a pristine sample is our goal. Bring it back to Earth and analyze it in our laboratories.
Now, this isn't just a simple grab and go. We're going to take a look at this particular object and figure out what the best sample will be.
That's true, and then we grab and go. So we do some remote sensing first. We find the safest area to get a sample, and we find the most scientifically interesting, looking at the spectrum of the surface and hoping to see some special signatures that might indicate organic material.
True, and you're involved with one of those cameras, are you not?
I am, and our camera suite has actually three cameras involved, and we first acquire the object as a point source at 10th or 12th magnitude, and then we follow as we get closer, imaging all the way down to the surface materials that are smaller than a centimeter. So our camera system has actually three parts to it, and we'll actually be taking video of the sampling process called a touch and go.
Well, that'll be exciting, and there's a lot of participation from all sorts of different countries, so it's a very international mission, is it not?
It is. There's a group from Canada building the laser altimeter, which is actually a scanning altimeter and actually takes a crude image of the surface, giving the surface topography, and will be quite important for helping us during the landing process.
Just one last question for you to any potential students out there who are sort of interested in space exploration. Maybe they've seen the images coming down from Curiosity, and now we've stoked their imaginations with talk of going out to an asteroid. What should they do? What advice would you have for them?
Well, we are in the midst of exploring our solar system, and for that matter, the galaxy and the universe. And there are many opportunities for future missions. None of the nations that we've talked about in this interview are thinking of quitting the space business, so there's going to be more and more missions. Those of us who've been around since the beginning are getting old and ready to retire, so there's openings. In other words, there's opportunities, and for those of you who are very interested in our place in the universe, this is the time to get involved. There is math and science involved, so you have to learn your math and science, and in that case, it'll serve you well in life anyway. So I highly recommend a career in space science.
Thank you very much, Peter, for joining me here today. It was a great conversation.
Thank you, John.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just heard the interview with Peter Smith, who, as we've discovered, has had a whole breadth of experience in a variety of space missions and quite a career so far. What stands out for me is that he says that, you know, considering all the opportunities that he's had so far, he still sees these opportunities for future students, and that the people coming in to take the place of those who are well into their career still have places to fill.
Yeah, there's a lot of different missions being planned still, and a lot of them are quite interesting. There's a lot of small missions being planned as opposed to very large missions, so there should be plenty of places for smart, experienced people or driven people to get involved.
People who are looking to get experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like the idea of getting more students into this field because this is practically, compared to other fields, this is a new field. You don't, not like 100 years ago, you could not go and like study, you know, planets and things like that by using rovers and technology that we have now compared to 100 or 200 years ago. And so as the technology advances, I think more opportunities will open up for everyone. Not only people in physics and astronomy or geological sciences, but with a wide spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the expertise involved is, you know, is quite something. So it does take a lot of training. It takes a lot of very intelligent people. And there's a lot of different roles there. As you say, it's not just engineers or physicists or astronomers, but geologists and a whole wide breadth of fields are involved.
It also includes a lot of studies.
Yeah, well, for sure. What's interesting is, you know, I think people don't always appreciate the extent to which students are involved in projects like this. I'm a student still, and I'm working on the NSF mission. And when I was down there in Mission Control, I found that I was surrounded by graduate students. There's plenty of professors, and there's plenty of experienced researchers, and there's NASA staff. But in among them, there are a fair number of graduate students from a variety of institutions who are there because their professor is involved and needs some assistance and needs a specific project to be worked on. That, you know, professor can't do everything, so they hire grad students to do these things.
And the experience you're getting is extremely valuable. Even if you decide to go into some other industry, that's going to pay off. So
yeah, absolutely.
This is good training.
Yeah, and so all of these missions, they'll have just kind of student participation. But I think, you know, very often when we talk about student stuff, we're thinking in high school and we're thinking in undergrad. But it's a grad school often where a lot of these opportunities really take off.
And I especially liked his comments when he was talking about motivating the younger generation, whether it be grad students or even younger. So space exploration has a very large role to play in not just being an industry, but in inspiring young people. And they don't necessarily have to go into space exploration via that inspiration, but they can become engineers, you know, they can become geologists, any number of different things. So it all leads to people who are inspired and people who are trying to do interesting things.
And I think what's also more important, especially like me being in astronomy, we see that like we use a lot of amateur astronomers, use a lot of work they do, which obviously they're not professionally astronomers, but they do a lot of observations which we as in astronomers cannot do it on a daily basis. So you don't have to be in the field to contribute to it. But if you are interested in it and if you are curious about things, you can help in many ways.
Yeah, an inspired person is a very powerful tool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of these missions that are coming up, OSIRIS-REx, this is exciting.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Anytime we can actually get a sample return from an asteroid, that's going to be extremely valuable. And I think this is a chondritic asteroid, isn't it?
That's expected, yeah.
So that's extremely valuable. That gives us a hint at some of the earliest things in the solar system, at really probing how the solar system was born. So to actually go there and get a sample, it's going to be extremely valuable.
And very difficult.
Yeah, very difficult. To imagine that we can do it at all, it's incredible.
Yeah,
even though this asteroid is a near-Earth asteroid, I think it's still pretty hard. This mission is pretty extended. It's not like, oh, you just fly 6 months in, you get stuff and you know, 6 months back. Not a year mission. It's long. Even though it being near-Earth asteroid only comes closer to Earth only once in 6 years, so we have this window of catching it while it's near-Earth on its orbit around the sun, it's going to be pretty hard, I would say.
Yeah,
it's a long-term
near-Earth is a relative thing. This is relatively near-Earth.
Moon
to
is near-Earth.
Like, yeah.
But that's it.
You talked a little bit about that process of, you know, how you get to the asteroid and you have that transit. But then you have to do the mapping and you have to do the characterization. And they have cameras and they have the laser altimeter. Just trying to figure out how is it rotating and what is its shape and how, you know, where are the safe places to try and approach it and how do you do that?
And I really like that idea of they don't, it's not like you're going to Mars and you have already decided where on Mars you want to land. On this asteroid, they're going to map and then they're going to decide which place would be good for us to land, which place would be good for us to have good samples, you know?
No, literally, they're doing it on the fly.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And it would be very interesting to be part of those discussions when they finally have global or near global map of, it's funny to call it global because the thing's probably not even around. but to have a...
If it's chondritic, it's not.
Yeah. To have a whole of body survey of that thing. And then to say, well, we think, based on the pictures, these are good spots for science. And the engineering team saying, but those are not good spots for landing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be a big decision. If they make contact and it's not a good spot, that's...
Mm-hmm. I mean, anything's better than nothing, right?
Yeah.
I guess they have, is it three tries that they get?
Yeah, three tries.
So well, let's hope at least one of those works.
Well, then you wait until 2023 to get the samples back and get all the work done right here, you know, holding a piece of asteroid would be amazing. So this would be probably the next generation grad students who would be doing
it. Hopefully I am no longer a student when this return happens.
But yeah, so it would be the incoming grad students, you know, in around late 2019.
We're talking a decade from now.
Yeah.
So people who are in grade 9 are going to be in the doctoral programs.
Yeah. Okay. So probably one of those students will get their hands on these kind
of... It's incredible how long-term these projects are.
Yeah.
Just to plan the mission takes forever. And it's an entire career to sit around and actually wait for the results.
Also like really based on like the budget, you know, how Peter should talked about it. It sounds a big number, but it's not. We use that much amount of money and a lot of stuff without even thinking. And this actually helps us long-term understanding why we are here, how we are here, and how long we are going to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Part of the reason it takes so long is inventing and then developing these new technologies, like the sampling system. How do you convince part of the asteroid to enter your spacecraft? You know, how do you do that? The Japanese had their Hayabusa mission a while ago, and they thought they had a plan. And it's described as a success because they did get some material, but it was a very, very small amount of material that they managed to capture. And after the tremendous difficulties of getting that spacecraft to come back to Earth, even more difficult than expected, you know, they open the canister and there's just tiny, tiny amounts, which is still valuable, but not what they had hoped.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a disappointment for grad students who are waiting to get their hands on such things. Mm-hmm. And turns
empty
out...
Empty canister.
Empty canister.
Yeah.
Oops.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's why we require the expertise, but this technology, it doesn't just go into a box that gets fired off into space. Of course, this technology benefits everyone. It has spin-offs, it trains people, and it contributes to, you know, the entire growth of our world. Our technology is all over the map.
Yeah, I know it's really weird when we go in the classroom and, you know, talk about the spin-off technologies, and people really don't have ideas about these kind of technologies that actually came from space program. You know, there are people who talk about why are we going to space, you know, why are we spending so much money, but they don't understand we get so much more out of it that you would not have thought about.
Yeah. And I don't think that the goal is necessarily to just do some stuff and hope for spin-off technologies. It's an important part. Spin-off technologies are quite impressive. But I think the goal is to train these people to do incredible things, to inspire the next generation to go and want to explore, and to really drive our world forward in a way we can be proud of.
Yeah, and it's not just the technologies. You're right. There's that first-order social effect of people notice that. And look at how many people watch the MSL landing live.
Yeah, and are still fascinated in the news that comes out of curiosity.
That's right. But then there's the second order social effect, which is that you have created, and when you do this, you create institutions that are able to fly spacecraft to other planets, and you create universities that are full of people who have the ability to solve these kinds of problems, and a whole ecosystem goes up around having that in your society. A society that has that is very different from a society that doesn't.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western Worlds is created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forrester and featured an interview by co-host John Moores. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis, David Kirsch, and Parshati Patel. Our editors were Zengyi Hu and Parshati Patel. And I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFN, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can once again find world enough and time for us next week, right here on astronomy.fm.